So I was thinking a little after our talk last week how providential it was that the talk on original justice coincided with the feast of Rosh Hashanah. And it was just fortuitous. I mean, it wasn't planned. But what Jews actually celebrate in Rosh Hashanah isn't simply the beginning of the year, right? That's how we think of it. But what is being celebrated is really creation itself, and in particular, the creation of man. Right? So last week, when we looked at original justice in which Adam and Eve were created, the Jewish world was celebrating precisely that creation of man, and therefore the kingship of God. Right? And so that's, in the Jewish tradition, you blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, right? The ram's horn, and that's a kingly, it's a kingly blowing. In other words, it's pointing to the majesty of God, the Creator, who becomes king precisely by having a free subject, man. Anyway, that was a beautiful coincidence. And right now, the Jewish world is preparing for Yom Kippur, the solemn day of atonement, in which, while the temple still stood, was the solemn sacrifice of atonement for the forgiveness of sins. No, and still is an occasion in which the Jewish world makes the sacrifice of prayer for the forgiveness of sins. So we can join with our Jewish brethren, no, in accompanying them as they do a solemn 24-hour fast. It's serious business. I mean, how many of us do a 24-hour complete fast even on Good Friday? No water even. No, and then they solemnly break the fast at sundown after Yom Kippur with a big feast. And that will be this Saturday night. Okay. All right, so let's go into our talk now. And it's a continuation of what we did last time on original sin. And what we'll look at is more in detail about the consequences of original sin and errors with regard to understanding those consequences. And we'll look in particular at the Pelagian heresy and at the Reformation. Okay. So last week we saw the principal consequences, and that was the fitting punishment for original sin was the loss of all the gifts above human nature, right? But not the corruption of human nature itself. And those gifts were supernatural and preternatural. Right? Preternatural means beyond human nature. Supernatural means above human nature. And we saw that the supernatural gifts are the name we give to those gifts that involve a sharing in God's life. That's supernatural. And that would be sanctifying grace, which is precisely a sharing in the divine life, and faith, hope, and charity, which flow from sanctifying grace. And also the infused moral virtues and the gifts of the Holy Spirit, we can reasonably think were included in that original justice. And the preternatural gifts were those gifts that were of an angelic dignity, immortality, freedom from suffering, and infused knowledge, and integrity, which was the lack of concupiscence. In other words, a special help that God gave to Adam and Eve, such that they were naked and not ashamed. And what that means is that their passions didn't rebel against reason, but God gave them the gift that their passions would be subordinated to reason, as long as reason itself was faithful to God. In other words, as long as they didn't rebel against God. And so the fitting penalty for original sin was the loss of all of those gifts, the supernatural and the preternatural. Sanctifying grace, faith, hope, and charity, gifts of the Holy Spirit, on the one hand, and immortality, immunity from suffering, infused knowledge, and integrity. Right? All of those gifts were lost. And it's fitting that they were lost because the original sin itself, we saw, was essentially motivated by a disordered desire for autonomy. Adam and Eve, especially we see it with Eve, Satan tempted Eve to desire the possession, as it were, of the knowledge of good and evil, so as to be like God in a way that a creature can't be, defining good and evil for themselves. I know it's desiring to be morally autonomous like God, as if we were to be autonomous like God is autonomous. And then a creature can't do that. Right? That's unreasonable. And so what's the fitting punishment? Well, they wanted autonomy in a disordered way. What did God give them? Autonomy. In other words, he left human nature to itself. Because in a sense, that's what they were choosing. And God respects choice. He respects our free choice, even when we wish sometimes that he didn't respect it so much. Right? And so they got autonomy. Autonomy in the sense of human nature being left to itself, deprived of those gifts above human nature, which were a pure, gratuitous gift, over and above being a rational animal. Okay. And so they wanted to be left to themselves to determine good and evil, and so their human nature was left to itself, stripped of those gifts that inclined it to the supernatural good, grace, charity, faith, hope, and charity, and also without those gifts that helped our lower nature from rebelling against our higher nature, integrity. Right? And what were they left with? Human nature. And all the faculties that go with human nature. In other words, they were left with rational animal, as we are at birth. Okay, so human nature wasn't essentially corrupted. We remain rational animals as Adam and Eve were by nature. So rationality wasn't lost, nor was free will lost. And so Adam and Eve remain our first parents. We could say they retain a headship over human nature with regard to nature. Right? All of us have received our human nature ultimately from them. Right? They passed on through generation. But we didn't receive those other gifts that were originally meant to be passed on also by generation, but which they lost and thus couldn't pass on to us. Right? And that's why we say original sin is transmitted by generation. Because what happens in generation? Human nature is given to us, but stripped of those gifts that Adam and Eve lost. Okay? Right? So Adam and Eve lost headship with regard to supernatural gifts. But they retained it with regard to natural gifts. So we can say that, for example, Adam calls Eve mother of all the living. And she's mother of all the living in the natural order, but not in the supernatural order. And now that belongs to another, to the new Eve, Mary. And Adam was the head according to nature, but thanks be to God, we have a new head, Christ, who restores the supernatural gifts that Adam lost. Right? And so if someone doesn't understand the doctrine of original sin, they won't be able to understand the mission of Christ. Right? Because he comes to restore precisely that which was lost. Right? If somebody doesn't think anything was lost, well then you wouldn't need Christ the Redeemer. And we'll see that's a huge problem in some strands of theology. Now, the biblical teaching on original sin is principally in Genesis 3 that we looked at last week. But there are other allusions to it. Brief, but let's look through them. Psalm 51, the Psalm of David, the penitential psalm after he sinned with Bathsheba, he says, "Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me." And it's reasonable to read in that a reference to original sin. Clearer is the later text of Wisdom and Ben Sirach, right, from maybe 800 years later. Ben Sirach He's writing in the 2nd century BC. Chapter 25, verse 24 says, "From a woman, sin had its beginning, and because of her, we all die." That's a clear reference to Eve and the transmission of original sin from Adam and Eve. Right, so we can see that in Jewish thought in the 2nd century BC, there was an understanding, on some level, of original sin and how it's passed on universally. We see it also in the Book of Wisdom, chapter 2, verse 23 and 24, which says, "For God created man for incorruption," right, for immortality, "and made him in the image of his own eternity. But through the devil's envy, death entered the world, and those who belong to his party experience it." It's a beautiful text. It's very rich. God created man for incorruption. That's precisely what we see in Genesis 2. That if they hadn't eaten of the apple, if they hadn't rebelled against that precept, death wouldn't have entered the world. But from the devil's envy, in other words, because the devil lost supernatural beatitude, he wanted to make sure nobody else had it. And so he, through envy, tempted Eve and led her to sin. No? And so through the devil's envy, death entered the world through his tempting Eve, who then tempted Adam. And those who belong to his party experience, that's actually a reference to the second death, the spiritual death. Yeah. Because all experience the physical death, but only those who belong to the devil experience the second death, the death of the soul as well as the body. Now we can see from these texts that the doctrine of original sin underwent a certain development within the history of Judaism. Just like everything else, the same thing is true of many other doctrines, like the resurrection. Right? It's not clear in the books of Moses, but it becomes progressively clear the closer you get to Christ. Right? And the same thing would be true of original sin. In the New Testament, Jesus doesn't speak about it directly, but we can hear hints of it if we know how to listen. And the clearest example would be his dialogue with the Pharisees on marriage. Right? And they were asking him, tempting him, asking about divorce, whether divorce is licit. No, and Jesus says, "For the hardness of your heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so." From the beginning. In other words, Jesus is alluding to an initial state in which divorce would not have been a dispensation granted to man, but that it became permitted out of the hardness of heart. And clearly that what we see there, the beginning and then the hardness of heart, is precisely what separates those two? The fall. Right? In the beginning, in other words, in Genesis 2, marriage would have had its full dignity and thus been absolutely indissoluble. But because of the consequences of the fall and the resulting hardness of heart of mankind as a result of the loss of those gifts, divorce was permitted even though it's against natural law, but because of weakness. And that is taken away by Christ precisely because he comes to undo the effects of original sin, at least the principal effect, which is the loss of grace and charity. Right? So Christ, by giving us these channels of grace and charity in the church, which are the sacraments, he restores marriage to its initial condition of being absolutely indissoluble. Right? And so that's an allusion to original sin there, even though he doesn't spell it out. But it's above all St. Paul that clarifies the doctrine of original sin. And he does it by comparing the original head of the human race, Adam, with the new head, Christ. So it's precisely in the texts that speak of Christ as the new Adam in which St. Paul clarifies the doctrine of original sin. magnificently. And we find it briefly in the first letter to Corinthians, chapter 15, the chapter on the resurrection, in which he writes, "For as by a man came death, by a man has also come the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, so also in Christ shall all be made alive." And so a clear parallelism. And since Christ is a universal redeemer who universally will give life in the last, not in the resurrection, we see by extension Adam likewise is the universal cause of death and the deprivation coming into the world deprived of grace. Right? Because if Adam was just the cause of ruin to himself, then he wouldn't be a parallel to Christ, who's the universal redeemer. Right? In other words, the parallel only works if Adam is the universal cause of the loss of original justice. Okay? And St. Paul develops it further in Romans chapter 5, which is the classic text on original sin. So he writes, "Therefore, as sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin." Now he's saying this one man is Adam, not Eve, because Adam was the head. So even though Eve sins first, it's ultimately Adam who has the headship, who, if he hadn't lost it, the supernatural gifts would still have been transmitted to us. Eve's sin would have hurt only herself. But Adam, as the head, by losing those gifts, lost it for all of us. Right? So as sin came into the world through one man and death through sin, and so death spread to all men, because all men sinned. Right? And that sin there is precisely the original sin, not a personal sin. "Yet death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those whose sins were not like the transgression of Adam, who was a type of the one to come." In other words, even somebody who dies, say, in children who die without sin, right, they still die. Right, even though they don't have personal sin. "But the free gift is not like the trespass. If many died through one man's trespass, much more have the grace of God and the free gift and the grace of that man, one man, Jesus Christ, abounded for many." In other words, there's a parallelism, but the second Adam outweighs the first. And in fact, immeasurably, infinitely. Right? Because the gift is much greater than the loss. "If because of one man's trespass, death reigned through that one man, much more will those who receive the abundance of grace and the free gift of righteousness reign in life through the one man, Jesus Christ. As one man's trespass led to condemnation for all men, so one man's act of righteousness leads to acquittal in life for all men." Right? So we see here very clearly that St. Paul is teaching that Adam's sin had consequences for everybody. Right? It led to the loss of grace for everyone, at least in our conception. We can get it back through the merits that Christ won for us on Calvary. Right? But we come into this world without it. Right? And so by one man's disobedience, by Adam's disobedience, many were made sinners. Sinners in this sense, not of having personal sin, but of being coming into this world without grace. And thus not in the friendship with God. And thus not equipped, if they die in that state, to go to heaven. Right? Because heaven is for those who die in the friendship with God. Okay? In other words, sinner, in these texts of St. Paul, has to be understood in an analogical sense. It has different meanings. Right? It doesn't necessarily mean personal sin. Right? It can also mean the sin of the nature, which is the loss of sanctifying grace. Okay? And so it's on the basis of these texts, above all of St. Paul, but obviously Genesis 3 and the other ones we looked at, that the church solemnly defined the doctrine of original sin. So that we'd start this by reading, well, what has the church proclaimed about this? And the key text is the Council of Trent. And so there are various canons about original sin. And so the first canon says this: if anyone does not confess that the first man, Adam, when he transgressed the commandment of God in paradise, immediately lost the holiness and justice in which he had been constituted, and through the offense of that sin, incurred the wrath and indignation of God and the death with which God had previously threatened him, and together with death, captivity under his power, that is, the devil's power, who thenceforth had the empire of death, and that the entire Adam, through that offense, was changed in body and soul for the worse, let him be anathema. Right? So Adam's sin had real consequences. That's what we're saying. And what were the real consequences? The loss of all those gifts. And not only for him, but for all his posterity. Right? And that's the second canon here. If anyone asserts that the transgression of Adam injured him alone and not his posterity, and that the holiness and justice he received from God, which he lost for himself alone and not for us also, right? Let him be anathema. And in other words, we can't hold that Adam's sin only affected him. Right? We have to hold that all of us are affected by Adam's sin, being deprived of those gifts that he lost for us. And therefore, death comes to us because of Adam's sin. Okay. Now, let's look now at the heresies with regard to original sin. And what we find here is two opposite heresies, and that's very frequent in the history of the church. In fact, it's a normal occurrence. And it's because the doctrine of the church, it's like a mountaintop, a mountain peak. And you can fall off it on one side or the other. No, and that's a very useful expression that I've repeated thousands of times probably up till now, and theologians frequently repeat. But it's useful to keep in mind. You can sin by defect, minimizing the doctrine, and that's what we usually think of. But you can also err by maximizing more, in other words, absolutizing or exaggerating beyond what the church holds. And so, with regard to original sin, there's a minimizing error, denying its essential nature, and there's an error of exaggeration, which is that of Martin Luther and those who follow. And so, let's look at those two things. So the minimizing error, the error of holding too little, came out about the year 400. With a very pious Christian theologian, apparently pious, in other words, seemingly very ascetical and of a strict life, named Pelagius. And Pelagius was a famous spiritual director and teacher, and his doctrine spread rapidly in the West, in Rome first, because that's where he was, and then after Rome was sacked in 410, he traveled and spread his doctrine along the way together with his followers. And what we don't have time to go into the whole history of it, but I'm just going to condense his doctrine with regard to original sin. Most people, when they hear Pelagius, they probably think of his another error with regard to grace. And we'll look at that later when we look at grace in later lectures. But for tonight, we'll just look at his doctrine on original sin. But the two things go together, right? Because the reason why he denied the necessity of grace for salvation was precisely because of a prior error with regard to original sin and what it implied. Right? And at root, the fundamental problem with Pelagius and Pelagianism is the failure to distinguish nature and grace. He attributed to nature what belongs to grace. In other words, he thought that charity was simply natural, and it was simply a property of free will. And since free will wasn't lost by the fall, he held that we weren't affected fundamentally by the fall, because we still have free will. He's right about that, we still have free will. But he assumed that charity simply was in the power of free will. And so if we haven't lost free will, we haven't lost charity, and therefore we could, if we really wanted to, be perfectly sinless throughout our life and merit heaven simply by our free will alone. So what's the problem? thinking that free will naturally has the capacity to supernaturally love God. In other words, to love God as Father above all things. And the fact is, nature doesn't have that capacity because that's something proper only to God, to love himself in a way that is proper to him. In other words, to enter into friendship with God is something that can't be natural to a creature. Now, we looked at that 2 weeks ago. And so Pelagius simply missed that entirely. And he thought that, well, we've got free will. Free will should be sufficient to avoid sin and to love God above all things. Yeah. And that would be to divinize man, ultimately. Right? We could say it this way. He failed to grasp the whole supernatural dimension, which is the grandeur of Christianity. Right? That charity isn't simply a human thing. Right? It's a divine thing. It's infinitely above the power of our souls. Okay, so to sum up his errors with regard to original sin, and this actually, they were summed up this way in the first trial that was brought against the followers of Pelagius back in the year 411. It was the first council in Africa that charged him with heresy. And the system was summed up in these 6 points. Even if Adam hadn't sinned, he would have died. Why? Because death is simply natural. Right? So that would be the first position. For Pelagius, death is something natural. And that's true. Death is natural. But Adam and Eve were given a gift above nature not to die. And so if they had been faithful, they wouldn't have died. Not because of human nature. Human nature is naturally immortal. It's not. Human nature is naturally mortal. But because of the divine gift. And so this is false. Even if Adam hadn't sinned, he would have died. Totally false. That would make a liar of God. Because God says, if you eat this tree, then you will surely die. But clearly the implications, if you don't eat it and are faithful, you will not die. Second error of Pelagius was thinking that Adam's sin hurt only himself. And the reason why he's thinking this is because he thinks, well, we still have free will. Free will can still love God above all things. Therefore, we're not essentially harmed by Adam's sin. Death is simply natural. We didn't get death from Adam's sin because death is natural. And we didn't lose the power to love God above all things because that's natural too. That's false, right? So it's false that the power to love God above all things is purely natural. And therefore, it's false that we weren't affected by Adam's fall, because in Adam's fall we lost the gifts that were above nature, and so we're very much affected. How affected? We've lost precisely that which puts us in friendship with God, without which, if we die without it, we can't go to heaven. So that's kind of an important way of being affected by Adam's fall. Another consequence that Pelagius drew from this is that children are born in the same state. Children today, just a newly born infant, is in the same state as Adam before his fall. In other words, precisely because he held that Adam's fall didn't bring about any change in the world. It just hurt Adam. And it hurts us only by imitation. In other words, because it was a kind of scandal. Being the first sin of many, it hurts us because we tend to imitate it. And so a consequence of this, an immediate consequence, would be babies, infants, wouldn't need baptism. Because they don't have anything in them that came from Adam's fall. In other words, they're not deprived of grace. Right? And so that was really what the whole controversy most focused on, because it's the practical issues that come out first. And so the practical issue is, do you baptize babies or do you not? And Pelagius was advocating not. Right? And so another consequence, the whole human race neither dies through Adam's sin or death, nor rises through the resurrection of Christ. We're not affected by Adam's sin, except as a model. Okay, and then those last two errors have more to do with grace. Since he denied the supernatural quality of grace and simply associated grace with fundamentally free will and good instruction, he equated the law of Moses was didn't really need anything. Mankind didn't need anything more ultimately than the law of Moses, which tells us the commandments, how to please God. Right? Because the essential thing that Christ gives in the gospel isn't a new law of in writing. Right? The new law of Christ is above all the grace to do what we already knew we were supposed to do, the double commandment of love. Right? The law already given in the Old Testament, in the Torah. Okay, so this is more or less the doctrine that Pelagius was teaching. And it appealed to some people because he emphasized man's dignity of still retaining free will. And that's a truth. But heresies always spread through the part of truth that they contain. And so Pelagius had a part of the truth. And that was we still have free will. And that free will is capable of avoiding individual sins when we put our mind to it. And that's true. But what's false is what he denied. And it's usually that way. This is a general rule. Heresies, they're usually right about what they affirm, but they're wrong about what they deny. Right? So he's right in affirming free will, but he's wrong in denying all those things that he just denied. The necessity of grace, the necessity of baptism for babies, and the real transmitting of original sin by generation. Okay, so Pelagius was condemned in various local councils, and finally, one of those local councils was approved by the Pope, Pope Zosimus, in the year 417-18. And I've given you here the canons. But the key idea is basically they refuted all of those points of Pelagius. It's the beginning of the 5th century. So something like 418, I think. And so the council emphasized that all of us receive death through Adam, and not simply by nature. And that baptism truly forgives sin, even in infants. Infants who have no personal sin, original sin is forgiven by baptism. And so baptism is for the remission of sins in everyone, right? Except for the Blessed Virgin. But for everyone else, baptism is for the remission of sins, at least original sin, right? Which has, it's not sin in the same sense as personal sin, but it means the loss of friendship with God, without which no one can get to heaven. Right? And so that's why baptism is absolutely necessary. Right? Because it restores that friendship with God. Okay. And the Council of Trent, 1,000 years later, solemnly reconfirmed the teaching condemning Pelagius. Solemnly and infallibly. And equally defining the necessity of infant baptism. Right? To restore that supernatural life that was lost by Adam's sin. Right? And so the Council of Trent says, if anyone denies that infants are to be baptized, even if they're born of baptized parents, let him be anathema. Okay, let's look now. We're going to come back to Pelagianism because it's reappeared in the modern world. But let's look first at the Lutheran, at the heresies that came out of the Reformation with regard to original sin, which is the opposite. All right, so here, first Martin Luther, followed by the the Protestant tradition in general, make two principal errors with regard to original sin. Right, so the first, we talked about last week, and it's the idea that original sin brings about a complete corruption of human nature. Right? And so that's why I call it an error of exaggerating or absolutizing. And so the error is the complete corruption. Clearly, we're affected by original sin, but not to the point of a complete corruption of human nature. And the reason why he held a complete corruption of human nature is because he identified the original state of original justice as simply human nature. In other words, for Luther, human nature in Eden was all of that. Sanctifying grace, faith, hope, and charity, integrity, all of that was simply human nature. And clearly what we have now is quite a bit different from that, and therefore, he reasoned, we have completely corrupted human nature. And that original, we could say that's a root error in the Lutheran, in the theology of Martin Luther, that is behind so many other positions that he took, which we'll see in later talks, like double predestination, or the inability of man to cooperate with God's grace. That comes out of this idea of complete corruption of human nature. Because if human nature is completely corrupt, there's nothing sound there that can cooperate with God's grace. And thus we can't be cooperators in the work of our redemption. And so we can say that his error with regard to original sin is the root of these other errors with regard to other aspects of grace. And what's behind this error is simply the failure to distinguish nature and grace. Right? So we could say that's the most fundamental error. He was looking at that original, and it's similar. The funny thing is it's similar to Pelagius. Right? And this often happens. The opposite heresies have a common root. They just express themselves in opposite forms. And in this case, the common root is the inability to distinguish nature and grace. So Pelagius, he lumps nature and grace together and thought that the original situation of Adam was simply nature. And Luther does the same. But they drew opposite conclusions. Pelagius drew the conclusion, okay, that original nature hasn't been corrupted, we still have free will, therefore Adam's sin hasn't changed us. Luther agrees with the initial presupposition. Adam's original condition was simply nature, but then he looks at the opposite. He said, we surely are changed, and therefore human nature is totally corrupt. And so they have a common premise, but they draw opposite conclusions. And so that common premise is the real problem. And that's what we especially have to be on guard against. And it's something that's very much out in the air. People don't clearly distinguish nature and grace generally. And we see it in all kinds of things. Just simply an example. People tend to think, well, heaven is due to us as long as I'm not a mass murderer. Not grasping that, I mean, heaven and grace, I mean, they are infinitely above us. They don't belong to human nature. They're not simply part of human nature. Okay. Let's look at some quotes of Luther in which so you see I'm not making this up. He writes he's a magnificent writer, absolutely magnificent. And so he says it in a very colorful way. And so this first one I've given you is from his homilies on the Psalms. And it would be on Psalm 51, the Psalm of David, where he speaks about original sin. And so he writes, the scholastic statement that natural powers are unimpaired is a horrible blasphemy. All right, what does that mean? Natural powers, that's precisely what I've been trying to teach. Natural powers are unimpaired. In other words, human nature, we still have it. And so our natural powers are unimpaired by original sin. Free will is unimpaired. Reason is unimpaired. But what's impaired is we lost those other gifts that were above human nature. Right? And so Luther knows the scholastic teaching. He just thinks it's dead wrong. Right? It's not as if he didn't know it. And not only does he think it's dead wrong, he thinks it's a horrible blasphemy. And by the way, the same thing, we hold the same thing is true about the devil. The devil also didn't lose the angelic nature. The devil has angelic nature the same now as before his fall. And that's why he can do harm. Right? What he lost was the supernatural charity, which was a gift that he abused and rejected. So even just as we retain human nature after the fall, but lost the gifts, so Satan retains angelic nature after the fall, but lost the gifts. And Luther thinks that's an even greater blasphemy. And in other words, he thinks that the nature of Satan became evil. But that's impossible. Natures remain good because God's the author of natures. So Satan's nature remains good today. And that's precisely why he can harm us so much. Because he retains that intelligence and that natural power. Okay. And so Luther reasons like this. If the natural powers are unimpaired, what need is there of Christ? Now all of you should be able to solve that. If natural powers are unimpaired, why do we need Christ? Because we lost the supernatural gifts that put us in friendship with God. It's not that hard, but he didn't see it. If by nature man has goodwill, and we think that he does have goodwill in the natural sense, but not in the supernatural sense, if by nature man has goodwill, if he has true understanding, to which, as they say, the will can naturally conform itself, what is it then that was lost in paradise through sin? And that had to be restored through the Son of God alone. Again, you should be able to answer. Supernatural gifts. Grace, faith, hope, and charity. Yet in our day, men who seem to be masters of theology, like me right here, defend the statement that the natural powers are unimpaired. That is, that the will is good. I scandalized that we were doing RCA, I guess it was last year, and I came out with this, the will remains naturally good. And someone in the class who was educated as a Protestant, no, that sounds scandalous to them. Yeah. Anyway. And then he goes on to say that the fact that we sin today, in other words, these scholastic theologians, they attribute this to the malice of men and not to the will as it is in itself. Think about that for a second. If I sin, who should I attribute that to? My corrupted will or myself? If I attribute it simply to my corrupted will alone, I'm attributing it to God. I'm doing what Adam and Eve did at the beginning. No, when God was looking for them and they were hiding and they said, he did it. Right? The woman that you gave me to eat. And that's really what's being said here. Right? If I sin, it's that corrupted will that's the problem. See, it's too easy. It's a doctrine that it takes away personal responsibility, if you take it in this extreme way. Let's look at another statement of Luther. Is from his commentary on Genesis 3. And this is Luther in his maturity, writing at the 1530s. So well after his break with the church. He says, the scholastics argue that original righteousness was not a part of man's nature, but like some adornment, was added to man as a gift. Right? That's exactly what I've been trying to teach. Okay? As when somebody places a wreath on a pretty girl. The wreath is certainly not a part of the virgin's nature. It's something apart from her nature. It came from outside and can be removed again without any injury to her nature. It's a good analogy. All right, wreath is too little, right? This grace is something much more magnificent than a wreath. But therefore, they maintain about man and about demons that although they have lost their original righteousness, their natural endowments have nevertheless remained pure, just as they were created in the beginning. And that's true, right? Our human nature remains the same. But these gifts, he's underestimating the gifts, right? He's thinking it was just as a wreath. And that's because he's attributing too much to nature in Eden. That's the funny thing is that Luther's error is essentially attributing much too much to man, oddly enough. Not man today, but man in Eden. They therefore maintain, people, these scholastic theologians, about man and about demons, that although they've lost their original righteousness, their natural endowments remain pure. But this idea must be shunned like poison, for it minimizes original sin. Right? So there's a real difference here. Like, this isn't just a fight about words. Sometimes people, and you hear people say today, that the whole Reformation was really a kind of, we really were holding the same thing about justification, and we were expressing the same ideas with different words and expressions. And you can see from these texts, that's not the case. There's a real difference of understanding, and we could say a certain radical difference. Let us rather maintain that righteousness was not a gift that came from without, separate from man's nature, but that it was truly a part of his nature, so that it was Adam's nature to love God, to believe God, to know God. Think of what's being said. What's being said is that to know God as God knows himself and to love God as God loves himself was natural to man in Eden. What would that make man in Eden? God. But how, I mean, a man can't be God. He's a creature. These things were just as natural for Adam as it's natural for the eyes to receive light. Right? Again, that's simply impossible. Right? That's like a black-white. That's like a wooden iron to say that a creature could naturally love God as God loves himself. That simply can't be. Because the creature would have to be God to love God naturally as God loves himself. But because you may correctly say that nature has been damaged if you render an eye defective by inflicting a wound, so after man has fallen from righteousness into sin, it is correct and truthful to say that our natural endowments are not perfect, but corrupted by sin. See, this is a logical inference from his initial mistake, thinking that Adam's original condition was simply natural. And so since we're changed, and there's no doubt about that, he draws the conclusion, essentially corrupted by sin. Just as the nature of the eye to see, so is the nature of reason and will in Adam to know God, to trust God, to fear God. Since it is a fact that this has now been lost, and we don't deny it, who is so foolish as to say that our natural endowments are still perfect? But you see, right, the reasoning doesn't hold. And yet nothing was more common and received more general acceptance in the schools, and he's quite right about this. And this is very interesting, no? Because it shows that Luther's doctrine wasn't commonly received in the school. Quite the contrary. What he learned in theology class was more or less what I'm teaching here. In other words, that Adam and Eve's situation in Eden was supernatural. And therefore, what was lost was that those supernatural and preternatural gifts, but the human nature remained the same. Right? He learned that in school, too. And that's why he says nothing was more common and received more general acceptance than this thesis that he's opposing. Right? So it would be a big mistake to think that Luther was being traditional in this. He perfectly well recognized that his teaching was totally contrary to everything that was received in the schools, in Catholic theology. Therefore, the perfect natural endowments of man were the knowledge of God, faith, fear, etc. These Satan has corrupted through sin, just as leprosy poisons the flesh. And so the will and reason have become depraved through sin. And get this, man not only does not love God any longer, but flees from him, hates him, and desires to be and live without him. Now, there's no doubt that that can happen, right? Adam fled from God. And all of us, when we sin, we do it, right? We flee from God. But that's not to say that the will always hates God and is incapable of not hating God. That's what he's saying, though. And he's saying that the will has been so corrupted that the will can't help but hate God by nature. Right? And that's false, right? That's not only false, that's blasphemous against God himself. That he would bring a creature into a state in which the creature can't help but hate God continually. Right? What kind of God would do that and then hold you responsible for it? Okay. All right, so that's the principal error. And now an immediate consequence of this is that if you hold that original state was nature, and there weren't any supernatural gifts at all in Eden, right, because that was simply nature, what will be the principal effect of original sin? Because let's first assume the true doctrine. The Catholic faith teaches, what's the essential effect of original sin? Loss of grace, right? The loss of grace, the loss of that friendship with God. In other words, the loss of sanctifying grace is the principal effect of. Now, Luther can't say that because he doesn't recognize in Adam's original state the existence of grace at all, because that was nature. And so he's going to have to say that something else is the principal consequence of original sin. And so it won't be the loss of sanctifying grace. It'll be simply concupiscence. Concupiscence spread in all the faculties of man. And so in the Lutheran tradition, and this is equally true of the Reformed tradition of Calvin, and correct me if I make mistakes, those of you who are more familiar with this, for the Reformed tradition also, the essential effect of original sin is concupiscence, which spreads through all of our faculties. And so I've given you here a quote from Calvin, from his Institutes, in which he says, original sin then may be defined, one of the nice things about Calvin is he gives you these clear definitions, may be defined a hereditary corruption and depravity of our nature, extending to all the parts of the soul, which first makes us obnoxious to the wrath of God, and then produces in us works which in Scripture are termed works of the flesh. Hence, those who have defined original sin as the want of the original righteousness which we ought to have had, who does that? Right? That's what we're doing, right? That's what the Catholic faith teaches. That, in other words, we give a different definition of original sin. It's the lack, the privation of sanctifying grace. Whereas Calvin wants to define it a different way, as this hereditary corruption and depravity of our nature that extends to all of our faculties and is essentially called concupiscence. And he says that the Catholic position, what I'm trying to teach you, that original sin is essentially the loss of that original justice that Adam and Eve were gifted with in Eden. He says, okay, could be true, but it's totally insufficient. They don't significantly enough express the power and energy of original sin. For our nature is not only utterly devoid of goodness, but so prolific in all kinds of evil that it can never be idle. Those who term it concupiscence use a word not very inappropriate. Provided it were added that everything which is in man, from the intellect to the will, from the soul even to the flesh, is defiled and pervaded with this concupiscence, or to express it more briefly, that the whole man is in himself nothing else but concupiscence. Wow. That's an exaggeration, right? That's why I call it an error of exaggerating or absolutizing. And clearly, I mean, that's simply not the case. No, that everything that's in man is concupiscence. But we'll see what the proper way of understanding the wounds of original sin in just a minute. All right, so what the Church holds about concupiscence is that concupiscence is the lack of integrity. And so integrity was being naked and not ashamed. So concupiscence is being naked and experiencing shame. And why do we experience shame? Because we experience involuntary, disordered movements of our passions even before we have a chance to deliberate and control them. Right? All of us experience that. In other words, the sense appetites do their own thing. And very often, most of the time, that doing its own thing isn't the right thing. And take the sexual sphere. It's very easy to see. There are lots of women in the world, but I have one spouse. And that means that the movement of my sense appetite, right, 99.99% of the time, is going to be disordered because not directed to my spouse. Even before I have a chance to deliberate, right, that's an example of what we call concupiscence. But it wouldn't only be with regard to lust. It'll be with regard to any of our passions before we have a chance to deliberate, like anger, like impatience, fear. I think of the fear that stops us from doing the good that we ought to do. And so that's what we call concupiscence. And it's not a sin in the sense of a personal sin. It's simply a state. And it's very important. So the fact that I experience concupiscence, that my sense appetite does its own thing before I have a chance to liberate, that's an occasion for merit. Because if I don't consent to my sense appetite doing its own thing, not only am I not doing the evil, but I'm actually meriting more grace if I'm already in a state of grace. Right? And so concupiscence is not a personal sin in us. It's not directly sinful. And God leaves it in us precisely so that, because this life is an arena of combat. And in the combat, we can sometimes be victorious. Not all the time, but at least sometimes. Right? And so that's why we say that concupiscence isn't the essence of original sin. Because it's not directly, it doesn't directly call down the wrath of God on us, concupiscence. This is really important, right? I think for the Protestant mentality, the very existence of concupiscence in me calls down the wrath of God. And that's false. Because in the baptized person, what happens? Original sin is forgiven, but the concupiscence stays. And my concupiscence that's involuntary in me doesn't call down the wrath of God, because after we're baptized and we're in friendship with God, God's wrath is not on us. Right? This is really important, because this kind of error of pessimism leads to, it leads to all kinds of, for one thing, scruples, and it ultimately, though, goes against the goodness of God. Right, that his wrath would be upon me for something that's involuntary in me. Okay. So, let's look now at the wounds caused by sin. So Luther and Calvin are certainly right in this. Right? Every heresy spreads precisely because of what's true and good in it. And so what's right in error with regard to original sin, what's right in it is that we do have wounds caused by original sin. So let's see how we should understand that. Right? And we've already explained it, no? We're wounded by original sin because we lost the gifts, supernatural and preternatural. Those are the wounds, precisely the loss of those gifts. That's what we mean when we talk about our wounded human nature. Now, to explain this, just in general, every sin leaves a wound. And the wound is an increased inclination to do similar acts. Right? So whenever we do a personal sin, any of us, that sin not only carries guilt with it, but it leaves a wound in me even after the guilt is forgiven. Because I'll have a stronger inclination to do those disordered acts. It's in that sense that we're speaking about the wounds of original sin. Because of the original sin and the loss, above all, of integrity, our faculties, not only integrity, first of all, sanctifying grace and also integrity, our faculties have a certain inclination to disordered objects prior to our deliberation. Because we lost those gifts. And we see this in our four principal faculties. And so the tradition speaks of four wounds of sin. Personal sins, but also original sin. So what are these four wounds? Well, they affect, first of all, our will, because that's the faculty that sins and chooses. Right? And so the wound from original sin that's in our will is precisely the loss of sanctifying grace. By not having sanctifying grace, our will can't love God above all things as our Father by itself. We need grace to do that. And so we can speak of that as a wound in our will, the inability to love God with charity and to love our neighbor with charity, supernatural charity. But we can still love God as creator and love our neighbor simply as neighbor, but not as a son of God, my Father. Right? So the wound in the will is the loss of supernatural charity, but that doesn't mean I've totally lost any kind of natural generosity. Right? We can still be naturally generous. Somebody who's in mortal sin, doesn't have charity, can still do works of generosity that put us to shame. It's just natural. Okay, then there's a wound in the intellect. The wound in the intellect was the loss of infused knowledge. Adam and Eve had some infused knowledge, and as a result of original sin, we're all born in total ignorance. That's the wound in the intellect. But it's remedied through faith. Right? Faith resupplies what was lost there. Just as baptism and grace resupplies what was lost to the will. Right? So the will, our will now, after baptism, has regained what was lost. Right? But what about our sense appetites? The sense appetites lost integrity. And what that means is they have that natural rebelliousness even before we deliberate. That remains with us. Christ didn't restore that in baptism. Right? Baptism doesn't change that. And so all of us still experience concupiscence, we said, as an arena of combat, as a trial, as a temptation. Right? And that is in our, we have two sense appetites. The concupiscible appetite that goes to sensible, pleasurable goods. And so the loss of integrity means that our sense appetite is immoderate. It goes, it's too easily attracted to pleasurable goods. Too easily seduced. Right? And we also have an irascible appetite that moves to arduous and difficult goods. And the result of the loss of integrity in our irascible appetite is a weakness. In other words, those arduous, difficult goods, very often we abandon them or flee from them because of the too great struggle as a result of the loss of integrity. And so those are the wounds caused by original sin. Right? And we speak of them as wounds because not with respect to human nature itself so much as with respect to original justice. In other words, they're wounds precisely by considering original justice as the original state. We're wounded in comparison to that. But we don't want to say that we're wounded in comparison simply with human nature. Okay? Now, the language of wounds comes from an allegorical interpretation, a beautiful interpretation of the parable of the Good Samaritan. So let's go through that. You all know the story. No, the Good Samaritan goes from Jerusalem to Jericho. Now, Jerusalem's sitting on a hill. You always go up to Jerusalem, and you go down when you leave Jerusalem, and Jericho's actually the lowest city on earth, 300 meters, I think, below sea level. And so the man who goes from Jerusalem to Jericho is going in the wrong direction. All right, and so you can see already that it's not, the parable is definitely about fraternal charity. No, that's the first meaning. But it's not only about fraternal charity. It's also about man's condition. Right, the man goes from Jerusalem to Jericho. On the way, he's halfway down. He's robbed. He's beaten. All his goods are taken from him. And he's left there half dead on the road, bleeding. Right, the Levite goes by, doesn't stop. The priest goes by, doesn't stop. That would be of the old law. No, of the Mosaic law. And then a Samaritan goes by, stops, has mercy on him, heals his wounds by applying oil and bandages, puts him on his mule, takes him to the inn, pays the innkeeper 2 coins to take care of him until he comes back, because he's going off on a long journey and will come back later. All right. And so the fathers of the church see in this parable a meaning about Adam and the whole human race. Who is the man going from Jerusalem to Jericho? Adam. And in Adam, us. We too were going from Jerusalem to Jericho. All right, what happened? Robbers attacked him and stripped him of the goods that he had. What should we read there? Stripped him of those supernatural gifts and preternatural gifts and left him naked on the road. Half dead. Half dead because he was the supernatural life was taken away from him, and he's left with only the natural. All right, the Levite and priest walk by, not simply because of, you know, complete irresponsibility. I mean, that's one meaning of the parable. But also, we should see a deeper meaning, that the old law, the Mosaic law, simply couldn't cure fallen Adam's condition. They couldn't cure it because the old law, the Mosaic law, couldn't give the grace. Because the grace has to be merited by God made man who gives his life for us. Right? And the old law, that hasn't yet been completed. And so that's why the Levite and the priest walk by. They can't cure the man lying on the road there. But the Samaritan, that represents Jesus. Right? Jesus is the Good Samaritan. And what does he do? He heals the man by applying oil and bandages. What should we read there? The sacraments. Like baptism, washing, and confirmation, anointing. He puts him on his mule and takes him to an inn. What should we understand the inn? The church. And he gives 2 coins to the innkeeper. And the father of the church, see in there the Old and the New Testaments, the Old and the New Covenants. And he goes off on a long journey. And what's that? He ascended into heaven. But he's coming back, he says, and he'll repay whatever is lacking. And that's the last judgment. Right? He'll come to repay. In other words, all the victims of injustice in all human history will be repaid. Seeing in this, I mean, it just opens up the parable to this magnificent vista. And this goes back to the early fathers of the church. We get this interpretation in Origen at the beginning of the 3rd century, and he recounts it as something that he learned. He didn't think of himself, but he learned from the ancient, from the fathers, the presbyters. In other words, something that was passed on, we could think, from the apostles. Beautiful. Right, and so that's why, since he was left there wounded, stripped and wounded, that's why the tradition speaks of 2 consequences. In other words, the loss of the gifts, but certain wounds in human nature, which would be that inclination, initial inclination, which we call concupiscence. Okay. The Council of Trent, I've given you here, but we don't have time. You can read it yourself on what it says about concupiscence. Right? That concupiscence is not sin in us, but it's an effect of original sin. And it's left in us for us to wrestle with. And it can't injure those, this is beautiful, it can't injure those who do not acquiesce. In other words, concupiscence doesn't injure anyone who doesn't consent to a disordered movement, but resist manfully by the grace of Jesus Christ. He who has striven lawfully will be crowned. Right? In the judgment. So this concupiscence, which the apostles sometimes called sin, the Holy Council declares that the Catholic Church has never understood to be called sin in the sense that it is truly and properly sin in those born again in baptism. But in the sense that it is from sin, it's a consequence of original sin, and inclines us to sin if we consent to it. If anyone is of the contrary opinion, let him be anathema. Okay, let's look now at some modern errors with regard to original sin. And what happens in the history of the church is that generally the errors are few in number and they just get repeated and recycled. The devil is great at recycling errors because he sees that we fall for it again and again. So why think of some whole entirely new error when the old one will do? All you have to do is repropose it and maybe change the trappings a little bit. And so this is exactly what's happened. The error of Pelagius has come back, but in a slightly different form. Right? And it's come from the idea of demythologizing the Bible. In other words, in the Enlightenment, the idea was widespread that the Bible is full of mythological elements that simply reflected the primitive state of mankind before the Enlightenment. In other words, everyone before the Enlightenment was a kind of primitive that believed in miracles and supernatural stories, etc., none of which we should take as being history. And so in the 18th century, in the Enlightenment, basically the people who held this were for the most part enemies of the church, like the deists and Masons and so forth. But in the 19th century, those movements tended to enter into Christian theology, first in the form of liberal Protestantism. So people like Strauss, there's a whole bunch of these, Schleiermacher was the first. And so it becomes a Christian position to strip away the supposedly mythological elements. Well, what are the first mythological elements that you're going to strip away if you start stripping away? Genesis 1 through 3. The fall, right? All of that. The apple, the garden, the original couple, all that's a pure myth. And if you view it as a myth, what's going to be the result? Man's simply naturally mortal. Right? Man's naturally mortal. And the original sin story, according to this mentality, is simply a kind of myth of origins. Now, and this is something that other cultures, in other religions, there are myths of origin that explain how we got to be this way. And it would be a mistake for us to take every myth of origin to be an historical account. That's true. And so the tendency of these scholars was to equate the biblical stories of the beginning of Genesis with the myths of other cultures. Simply, the idea was they were myths to account for our state. So we shouldn't think that there was an original sin. Simply that the story was told to account for the fact that now we die. That now we experience ignorance and suffering and the rebellion of our sense appetites. And so what's the result? The result is that the same as Pelagius. Exactly. Right? Adam's sin only hurt him, if there even was an Adam. Let me just give you an example. Sorry to do this. I just was browsing the library today in Kenrick, and a recent book of Catholic theology was on original sin, so I opened it up to this page, and this is what I read. In light of what scientists can tell us about human origins, modern Catholic biblical scholars recognize that the origin stories in Genesis 1 to 11 are not meant to be understood as historical fact. Therefore, we need not take as literal truth that human beings began their existence in a paradise, were endowed with beyond human capabilities of knowledge and bodily control, and were without suffering and death. Right? We're not to take that as historical fact. And most important of all, one need not conclude that there was an offense committed by the first human beings so horrible that the justice of God demanded that henceforth they and their descendants be punished with suffering and death and declared guilty of damnation, eternal damnation. Now, he's phrased it as one need not conclude, but clearly the position of the author is one should not conclude any of those things. Now, that should ring a bell, right? That's exactly, isn't it, what Pelagius was saying and was condemned for. Except this is a little more radical, because this would go to deny that there even was an original couple. Now, so what should we think about this? There's no doubt. Now, again, every error has a part of the truth. So the part of the truth here is that there's no doubt that the initial chapters of Genesis are not history in the ordinary sense of the word. Simply because it's recounting the tale of the origins, which is prehistorical, right? Prehistorical means before writing, before historical documents and sources. And there's no doubt that what happened in Genesis is, in that sense, prehistorical. And so we shouldn't expect a historical account like we might read of the Peloponnesian War or any other war that's recounted in an historical epic, like the Greek histories or the Gallic War of Caesar. But that doesn't mean that they're mere myths. Right? It would be a false dichotomy to say, well, they're not history in the sense of the Gallic Wars, therefore they're simply myths with no basis in historical reality. And the church doesn't allow us to take that other option. And this got clarified most clearly by Pius XII, 60 years ago, in an encyclical, 1950, Humani Generis, a great encyclical. Controversial, precisely because of what he said about this and other things. And so what he says about Genesis 1 through 11 is that they're to be understood as true history, but expressed in a very archaic and symbolic metaphorical form. Right? So that's the balance. No, you can fall off the mountain both sides, right? In other words, a literalistic reading would fall off one side of the mountain. Ascribing the stories to pure myth would be falling off the other side. Right? And the balance is, it's not a myth, and I'll clarify the word myth in a second, but nor is it to be taken literalistically. In other words, without properly understanding metaphors. And an example of that is what we did last week when we looked at what was the nature of that original sin. Not simply eating an apple, right? But what did it signify? That's what we're supposed to understand as historical truth. Okay? So Pius XII writes this. In a particular way must be deplored a certain too free interpretation of the historical books of the Old Testament. Those who favor the system refer to a certain letter, etc. But this letter, I can explain that in the break if anybody wants to know. This letter points out that the first 11 chapters of Genesis, although properly speaking, not conforming to the historical method used by the best Greek and Latin writers, right, clearly it's different than the Peloponnesian Wars, do nevertheless pertain to history in a true sense. That's the key phrase. Genesis 1 through 11 pertains to history in a true sense. Now, this is ordinary magisterium of the church, and we have to abide by this. Now, we have to give this religious submission of mind and will. It's true, it needs to be further studied by exegetes, etc. It points out in simple and metaphorical language, adapted to the mentality of a people but little cultured, the principal truths which are fundamental for our salvation. Right? Those are historic. See, the truths in Genesis, it would be totally wrongheaded to think that the truths in Genesis could be understood without any reference to history, because the truths in Genesis are about man's history. Right? That's what Genesis teaches, that at the beginning of human history, a free event occurred which changed our condition in human history. And so the fact of history is essential to what's being taught in Genesis. In other words, because the reason why I say it is many theologians say, okay, the Bible teaches us religious truths, but with the historicity of the events is unimportant. Let's apply that to the Passion of Christ. Okay, there's a religious truth that Christ died for our sins, but the history is unimportant. Right? Everybody can see that that's ridiculous, because Christ redeemed us from sin by dying in human history. And that's why we put Pontius Pilate in the creed. Right? We put somebody in the creed who is not a salvific figure because it shows the history, that this occurred in human history. And Genesis is no different. If that sin didn't occur in human history, well, then we don't need Christ redeeming us in human history. Right? And so Genesis 1 through 11 has to be about history, not just abstract truths that are true independently of history, because it's about sin. Okay. Anyway, so he finishes up by saying that what we can't say is that these things are myths, on a par with myths or other such things. Now, John Paul II clarified that a little bit and said, if somebody wants to use the word mythic to refer to the archaic language and the metaphors, then that could be acceptable, as long as myth doesn't mean a fictitious story. If by fictitious story, somebody's saying the word myth, well, then that's can't be used. But if you simply mean this kind of archaic, metaphorical way of speaking about those events of the origin, well, then one could use that word. Right? So it's not to get into a fight about a word, but about the substance. Right? The key point is that there's something historical there in Genesis 1 through 3. And this was already clarified earlier by a document of the Pontifical Biblical Commission right at the beginning of the 20th century, 1909. Right? And the doubt was, do we have to think of, in other words, can we view this as a kind of fable or myth like the myths of other peoples? And the answer, no. Right. Right, well, that's the work of catechesis. Right? That's what we're called to do, is to, when we present the faith, to put what's essential and to distinguish it from there. But we've got a magisterium of the church. We've got John Paul. We've got Benedict. We've got the Catechism of the Catholic. The Catechism of the Catholic Church is magnificent in this regard.
But the people
outside of it. Okay. Right. Right. That's right. Right. And see, a lot of people reject the Catholic faith because they're rejecting something that they think is the Catholic faith but isn't. Let's just look at an example of that. This is what do modern Jews think about original sin? And so modern Jewish thought very frequently distances itself from original sin, claiming that it has nothing to do with Judaism or the Torah, but it's a Christian invention, and precisely of Paul. And generally, this position that is very frequent in 20th century Jewish thought goes together with a certain view that Genesis presents myths. In other words, many Jewish scholars accept the demythologizing, just like many Christian ones do. And there's an interesting book here, Where Judaism Differs, a beautiful book in many ways, where he talks about how Judaism is different from Christianity. And one of the things he deals with is original sin. And so he writes, "The idea that man needs to be saved from some original sin is not part of Judaism. Nor does Jewish theology accept the doctrine of man's corrupt origin. In the Haggadah of the rabbis," that would be the rabbinical tradition, the stories that the rabbis tell, "the scenes and characters of the Genesis Paradise saga appear not in free." In other words, he admits that in the rabbinical tradition, there's quite a large place given to original sin and its consequences. And in particular, the idea that of concupiscence, there's an expression in Hebrew, the yetzer hara, the evil inclination that comes from original sin. And so that's part of the Jewish tradition, is an understanding of original sin and its at least the consequence of concupiscence. But it's true that the consequence of the loss of grace, that's not clear, because Jewish theology never had a precise understanding of grace, because that really comes with the fullness of revelation with Christ. And it even took the church centuries to sort that out, precisely through the Pelagian controversy. But an interesting thing about his remarks here is that you can see what he's really rejecting, above all, is the Protestant idea of total depravity. So he writes, "It's true that the rabbis speak of this, but no doctrinal consequences were ever drawn from the Garden of Eden legend," he calls it a legend for Judaism, "as was the case with Christianity. The Genesis myths," "were in no way decisive for the theology of Judaism. Man is never confronted with the fact of a total and irrevocable depravity demanding total regeneration, rebirth into a new Adam." And we don't hold that either, right? In other words, what he's really rejecting there is the Lutheran and Calvinist doctrine, and that he's right to reject it. Okay. Let's just one last point before I've gone way over my time. Why did God permit the original sin? And there's a general answer to why God permitted anything. And what is it? He permits evil to bring forth a greater good. What would be the greater good with regard to original sin? Christ's incarnation and redemptive passion. Right? That's the greater good. And so that's why God permitted original sin, so that his love could be more manifested than could possibly be the case in any other way, by becoming man to save mankind from eternal damnation, by giving his life for us on the cross with every drop of blood. The Catechism explains this beautifully in number 412, and it's most beautifully expressed in the Easter Vigil Mass, the Exultet, which is one of the most beautiful liturgical songs of the whole liturgical year. And the deacon sings it solemnly. This is the night, right? Easter Vigil night, Easter night, when Christians everywhere, washed clean. And the reason why this is sung on the Easter Vigil is because that's when adults receive baptism, traditionally. Right? So it's celebrating the conquest of original sin through baptism. This is the night when Christians everywhere, washed clean of sin and freed from all defilement, are restored to grace and grow together in holiness. This is the night when Jesus broke the chains of death and rose triumphant from the grave. What good would life have been to us had not Christ come as our Redeemer? To ransom a slave, you gave away your son. O happy fault, O necessary sin of Adam, which gained for us so great a redeemer. Right? What an audacious phrase to call Adam's sin a happy fault. Obviously, it's not at all happy in itself, but only in this consequence, the incarnation of Christ. Most blessed of all nights. Let's take our break here.